The following Dominican University of California production has been brought to you by radio.dominican.edu.
Good afternoon, Penguin Radio listeners. This is radio.dominican.edu. I'm DJ Noni, and I am here in Guzman Lecture Hall with the Big History Program, where we're going to hear from Dr. Scott Sinclair on the evolution of love, religion, and science, a brief history of a big topic. And now, Dr. Scott Sinclair.
As advertised, I am indeed Scott Sinclair, and I'm a member of the Dominican faculty. The talk I'm about to give is the latest in a series of lectures jointly sponsored by the Big History Program, Campus Ministry, and the Division of Humanities, Religion, and Philosophy. The goal of the series is to deal with the intersection, the interaction of big history, religion, and ethics. And as has been previously announced, the title of my talk is The Evolution of Love, Religion, and Science, a brief history of a big topic. In many big history courses, students have to write a treatment of how some specific thing evolved over the huge time frame of big history. So if your topic happens to be chewing gum, you'd begin by the formation of the hydrogen atoms in chewing gum during the Big Bang, continue with the formation of the heavier elements such as carbon in the cores of large stars, then eventually you would get to when chewing gum was invented in human history, and you would end with the prospects of the future of chewing gum. Since my assignment is to talk about the intersection of religion, ethics, and big history, I thought it would be good to do a similar survey of the big history, not of chewing gum, but instead of three things which are so relevant to meaning: love, religion, and science. How do these three things originate? How do they evolve? How are they related to each other? And what are the prospects for their futures? We use the word love to cover almost everything in contemporary English. You can even say that you have an overwhelming love for chocolate ice cream. So I thought it better be clear what I mean when I use the term love in this lecture. What I'm saying here is that love is a positive attitude which manifests itself in appropriate, concrete ways. Thus, actions which may be helpful but are not motivated by genuine concern, but by something else, cannot be love. I may desperately need a large loan, and if the bank gives it to me, but in order to make a profit on a high interest rate, we would not consider that the loan was an expression of the bank's love for me. Similarly, a positive concern which never manifests itself in concrete actions, even when they are very called for, is not what I mean by love. For me, the statement, "I love my children, but I do not pay child support or ever talk to them," is a contradiction. Someone who does not respond to their positive concern with concrete actions is not doing what I call love. From an evolutionary perspective, love co-evolved with the helplessness of infants in certain species. In many species, contacts between mates are very brief, and the offspring have no real relationship to their parents. From their birth, they are self-sufficient. In relations like this, it seems inappropriate to say that parental snakes love their children. In the course of evolution, however, in some species, particularly in birds and mammals, newborns became helpless for long periods of time. For weeks or even years, they were totally dependent on parents for food and many other forms of nurturing. The parents often even had to cooperate to keep the newborns alive. It is clear that in these species, parents at least act lovingly. They act as if they had genuine concern for their children. And I think we can assume that the rudiments of psychological love, of genuine concern, are also present. At least in the case of pets, we even feel the love which pets have toward us, not simply by their behavior, but also by our sense of their loving presence. It would probably be a mistake to say that one thing caused the other in evolution. It'd be a mistake to say that newborns first became helpless and then psychological concern developed, or on the reverse, that parents began to love and then newborns became helpless. I suspect this is another case of co-evolution, where the two things evolved together. As the infants were increasingly helpless, the parents became increasingly loving, and as the parents became increasingly loving, then newborns became increasingly helpless. Now, I showed you a slide of penguins to show you your early childhood. Since you are all penguins, you should remember how your father penguin doted over you, and how your mother penguin was always attentive to your needs when you could not help yourself. Now, as in the case of other thresholds, emergent properties arose with the appearance of love for newborns. Here I'm going to abandon penguins, even you, and restrict our comments to humans in general. Humans in general began to be able to discern whether or not someone else really cares. We become tremendously worried about how people feel about us, and we begin to pick it up. Of course, some of that discernment is based on empirical observation. We notice whether people are holding hands or kissing or whatever. But some of that is also what we call picking up the vibes. Here we come to something which is quite mysterious from a scientific point of view. We don't know how the human mind does it, but we certainly know from experience that we do. We can enter a room and we just feel the anger in the room, or we feel the tension in the room. You students do this to me during examinations. I come to the midterm or the final expecting to get work done, and then the tension of the room so gasses me out that I'm not able to do the reading that I intended. So too, it is a common experience that we pick up whether someone loves us or not. The question is, how does this happen? Since as yet we have no scientific data, I would just venture the hypothesis that our thoughts, which are basically electric fields, are able to be picked up by other brains. Okay? That we generate an electric field by the love which we have, and another brain is able somehow to pick up those signals. Whether or not that hypothesis turns out to be true, it certainly is the case that with love, as in other emotions, we project some kind of energy which other people are able to discern. Now, people who were especially gifted in inner perception and expanded that perception through meditation began to feel another kind of love. Before going on, it should be said that perception of love is like every other kind of perception. Some people have more of it than others. And like everything else, the perception can be refined and increased by disciplined practice. So people who are naturally gifted inner perception and then developed it by techniques we might call religious, by prayer and meditation, began to detect that there was a general kind of love that it was available in any place or any time. You could feel it even when there was no one else around, when you were all alone. And they began to talk about a love from God or a love from some kind of spirit. I would suggest this goes way back to pre-literate times. Unfortunately, before writing, we don't have a lot of documentation, and we have to rely on hunter-gatherer people who have civilizations which have survived into modern times. The slide I'm showing you is of the great Native American, the Sioux healer and visionary, Black Elk. Here is a selection from his words as recorded in Professor Novak's anthology. Professor Novak, as you know, teaches here at Dominican. Here's what Black Elk says. Even in the very lightest breeze, you can hear the voice of the cottonwood tree. This, we understand, is its prayer to the Great Spirit. All things and all beings pray to him continually in differing ways, for the Great Spirit is everywhere. He hears whatever is in our minds and hearts. But despite that experience of universal love, it was clear that the natural world was not always loving. In the slide, you can see a particularly drastic volcanic eruption. And primitive people thought that almost everything was alive and had thoughts and feelings. Our first assumption is almost always that other people are like us, and primitive people had the same feeling about nature. Nature is like we are. So, I have thoughts and feelings, so does the volcano. And of course it's alive, it's even throwing things at us, and it is angry. Of course, volcanoes were only one of the many powerful things that were terribly dangerous to human beings. There were floods, there were earthquakes. Consequently, it appeared there were superhuman forces, spirits and gods, that had attitudes which were often arbitrary, attitudes which could even be violent and sadistic. Such forces had to be dealt with. If possible, they had to be placated. Consequently, various rites arose, which from our perspective were cruel. In the slide, we have a picture of human sacrifice being offered in ancient Hawaii. Did I offend anyone? Is there anyone out there from Hawaii? Well, I don't mean to demean your culture, because human sacrifice arose independently in many different times and places, including in the culture from which the Bible came. In the Hebrew scriptures, the Old Testament, the prophets are always attacking human sacrifice, railing against it. But of course, the reason they're railing against it is because it was actually being practiced. So, with the Hebrew prophets, we come to a major threshold in the history of religion. Around the 5th century before the Common Era, apparently largely independently, in various places, in Greece, in Israel, in India, in China, a new kind of religion arose. It was a religion which emphasized universal ethics and rational inquiry. An ethics which emphasized that we must be good all the time, and a religion which emphasized that ethics and other ideas have to be analyzed for their validity. We might pause for a moment and take a step backwards and ask, what were the conditions which caused axial religions to arise? Earlier, I mentioned hunter-gatherer societies, and in those societies, life was relatively egalitarian because small groups were small, no more than 100 about, and all contact was face to face. In those situations, it was hard for one person to oppress everybody else. But with the agricultural revolution, larger communities became possible. And in due time, you have even major cities, cities with, say, 25,000 people. In those cities, you had to have class differentiation because somebody had to be organizing the irrigation system and somebody had to be digging out the canals. As a result, then you have emperors, kings, people at the top, and then, alas, increasingly people at the bottom who are being exploited. So the emperor on top and his slaves at the bottom. Now, this system of differentiation and exploitation then inspired ethically sensitive people to ask, can the gods really be on the side of this dehumanization, especially if it's a dehumanization of my family and friends? And then these sensitive people began to say, no, the gods cannot possibly be in favor of this. The gods are always ethical. The Great Spirit always in favor of justice and mercy. Along with this insight arose rational thinking. Previously, all you could do was tell stories. You couldn't analyze them. If you didn't like the story, you could tell another story or tell the same story slightly differently. But you couldn't analyze it and figure out what in this story is not consistent. Okay. Now, in the slide, you see a picture of Socrates, one of the great founders of Greek philosophy. And he liked to say he was the only person who didn't know. He said, other people think they know things, but when I question them, pretty soon they realize that what they're saying isn't consistent, and at last I have gotten them to realize they don't know. That is logical analysis. But what Socrates said was also said, for example, in China by Confucius, that the most important thing is to know what you don't know. As time went on the basis of mystical experience, that is, on the basis of experiencing love from God, there was, among the mystics, the emphasis that the divine was wholly good. In the slide, we have a modern artist's conception of Julian of Norwich, a mystic who was born around 1342. In some ways, she seems to me, maybe to all of us, hopelessly medieval. In those days, if you were a woman and were not prepared to live in a monastic community, but still wanted to devote yourself to prayer and meditation, you were normally enclosed. That is, you were sealed in a cell from which you never emerged, and things like food were passed to you through a window. Yike! But in other ways, Julian was centuries ahead of her time, maybe even a little ahead of our time. She was the first woman ever to write a book in the English language. In that book, she used feminine as well as masculine images in speaking of God and even of Jesus, despite the fact that anatomically he was undeniably male. She called God and even Jesus our mother. But for the purposes of this lecture, what is more important is that on the basis of her vision, she insisted that God was wholly good. She said there was no anger in God. Let me quote from chapter 45 of her book. I understood that sinners sometimes desire blame and wrath, and I could not see these two in God. In the slide, we have an illustration of one of her visions. She saw a small, fragile ball. It was in the palm of her hand, no bigger than a hazelnut. She wondered what it was and how something so weak could endure. God, in response, told her that she was looking at all that exists, the entire universe, and that from his perspective, this tiny reality was only kept in existence by his continual love. But the claim that God was always loving and merciful was constantly called into question by the arbitrariness of natural events. Even today, we still call them acts of God. The natural disaster which most affected Julian's life was the arrival of the Black Death in England when she was only around 6 years old. The plague lasted for years, killed perhaps half the population of Western Europe, and so it must have dominated her formative experience. In response to this horrific act of God, people first tried to placate God by religious rites, by services, by penances. And when God was not placated, in certain places in Europe, they took more drastic action. They slaughtered Jews. It is a testimony of the power of Julian's experience of God's love that, given her life's experience, that she could nevertheless insist that God never gets angry, never is vindictive. It is also not surprising that Julian's claim that God is always loving and merciful does not seem to have been taken seriously by many at the time. Then, modern science showed that we didn't have to look at things in this way. The rise of modern science showed that natural events are caused only by natural causes. I hope you like the gerbil in the picture. Isn't he cute? But unfortunately, modern scientists think that very probably he was, maybe it was a she. Anyway, the gerbils were responsible in part for the Black Death. We don't know too much about a disease which took place 600 years ago, but the most likely theory is the bacterium which caused the plague lived in the stomach of fleas. The fleas, in turn, lived on rodents like this gerbil, and the fleas then leaped onto human beings, and that's how the disease was spread. So modern science made it possible to purify religion. We no longer had to insist that God was angry and that's why he's killing half the population. Now we can see that it is bacteria spread by rodents and fleas that is the problem. Now ultimate reality could be seen as wholly loving. Today, educated people do not normally blame God for natural disasters. Religious people normally have no problem with saying that God is always merciful. So, if there is an earthquake in 5 minutes and we have to evacuate this hall, no one will ask, which students offended God by not listening to this lecture, but instead by texting? And how many of you will we have to offer as human sacrifices to make God stop sending earthquakes? No one is going to ask that question. So far, then, we have dealt with a few reflections on love and religion from a big history perspective. I'd now like to turn to some reflections on the big history of science. Before the modern period, the study of the natural world and the spiritual one were done as much by interior experience as by actual empirical observation. We may note in passing that mathematics is a remnant of this earlier approach. Mathematics is an exercise in pure logic, where you don't deal with empirical observation, but with the logical consequences of hypothesizing pure forms like points and lines and triangles and numbers. Okay? There is no necessary connection between mathematics and the empirical world. We'll return to that problem a little later. Now, in the slide, we have a representation of the universe as was understood in Europe before Copernicus made the alarming discovery that the sun was not revolving around the earth, but the earth was revolving around the sun. As the illustration shows, the spiritual was very much projected into that earlier understanding. The heavenly bodies rotated in perfect circles. Okay. The sun, the moon, the stars were made of a superior, more sublime, more subtle substance than the gross things we have on earth. The heavens were flawless. They were unchanging. And they were kept in motion by the unmoved mover, who at least in Christian Europe was understood to be God. People noticed that when things are set in motion, they always tend to slow down. So they ask, why don't the heavens grind to a halt? And the answer is, God is up there pedaling. So God was actually part of the scientific understanding of the universe. And incidentally, up there, above the highest sphere, is the place where the souls of the righteous are busy basking in heavenly glory. So this earlier image of the universe was only partly based on observation. Perhaps it was more based on philosophical and religious concepts and values. Now, in the next slide, we see Galileo with his telescope. Galileo is sometimes called the founder of modern science because perhaps he, more than anyone else, turned science toward empirical observation. In the slide, Galileo is peering into the heavenly bodies. And when he did that, he discovered that, of course, the heavens were not perfect, and they certainly were not unchanging. The sun could have spots on it. There were mountains on the moon. A star could nova and appear, and then it could disappear. All of this, then, was a harbinger of what was to come. In time, science more and more abandoned inner experience as evidence for how the universe had to be. It focused more and more on what you could observe by the senses. And technology found ways to make the senses a million times more sensitive. You could have electronic microscopes. You could have radio telescopes. You could have X-rays. Our internal intuitions might be suitable for framing hypotheses to be tested, but nothing could be proved unless it was empirically observed. Consequently, science could no longer comment on the spiritual or even on the ethical. Science no longer had anything to say about what was right or wrong. All it could do was provide information about the natural world. At most, science could observe the outer signs of spiritual things. Thus, if a monk is meditating, science can hook up devices on the head, and you can see how the brain waves change as the person enters into meditation. But you can't say anything about whether meditation is a valuable thing. Now, as science became ever more powerful, it became clear that all that power could be used as much for evil as for good. As a result, science raised ever more fundamental moral issues, which could not be resolved on any scientific basis. Perhaps the greatest theoretical achievement of science in the first half of the 20th century was the realization that matter could be converted into energy, a theory summarized in Einstein's famous equation that energy equals mass times the speed of light squared. A result of that triumph is in front of you. There is a picture of Hiroshima shortly after the United States dropped the first atomic bomb. As science tried to explain the mind on the basis of natural causation, the question arose whether even ethical reflection had any justification. If our minds are simply the product of chemistry or physiology, if the way we think has simply been determined by the accidents of evolution, why should we take values seriously? Maybe they are arbitrary, totally accidental, with no continuing validity. Why should we think that some things are right and other things are wrong? But at least it appeared that empirical science could explain nature without appealing to God. Laplace was one of the greatest scientists of the 19th century, and he was wrongly quoted as having said, "God is an unnecessary hypothesis." The fact that so many people thought that he had said that showed the tenor of the times in the 19th century. After Darwin especially, it was felt science has no need of postulating a God to explain anything, at least in the scientific empirical universe. There was a sense that further scientific discoveries would explain everything. The God of the gaps would disappear. We'd have a total understanding of the universe through physical laws. But recently, naturalistic explanations of basic phenomena in the universe have had to postulate enormous coincidences. Here, I will have to limit myself to four illustrations. The first is the fine-tuning of the Big Bang and the general laws of physics and chemistry to make life even possible. Here are a couple examples of many others. If 1 second after the Big Bang, the force of the explosion had been stronger or weaker by 1 × 10⁻⁵, that is decimal point followed by 14 zeros followed by a one, life could never have emerged. According to Roger Penrose, I'm sorry, that's according to Sir Roger Penrose, knighted for his scientific achievements, the odds of the Big Bang producing a universe with sufficiently low entropy to produce 100 billion galaxies, that is, a universe where there'd be enough planets so that life would form somewhere, the possibility of that is 1 out of 10, to the 10th, to the 123rd. If you were to write that number in a single column, it would stretch beyond the stars. If the atomic strong force were 1/250th different, life could not have arisen. If the force of gravity were changed by only 3 times 10 to the minus 37th, that's decimal point followed by 36 zeros followed by a 3, life would be impossible. A second problem which has continued to haunt modern science is Wallace's conundrum. Wallace was one of the early champions of evolution, a supporter of Charles Darwin. But he was haunted by the question, which also bothered Darwin, as a matter of fact, of why spiritual abilities, which in no way contribute to survival during biological evolution, were nevertheless naturally selected. As human beings, we have the ability to do higher mathematics and nuclear physics. We have spiritual abilities such as to meditate. How did that help drive away the saber-toothed tiger? Or how did that help us hunt down the bison? Worse, our ability to do science depends on these abilities. And if these abilities were simply arbitrarily determined by the accidents of evolution, then the issue must arise whether the data we gain by using these abilities is really objectively true and valid, or we're merely kidding ourselves because of we were programmed to come up with such conclusions. A third thing, which is very difficult to deal with if you only deal with natural causation, is near-death out-of-body experiences. Now, until quite recently, people who were very close to death almost always died. But thanks to the miracles of modern medical technology, to say nothing of the expertise of Dominican nursing graduates, now people who have been clinically dead, that is, their hearts have stopped beating, and maybe even their brain waves have stopped, gone flat, are able to be revived, brought back to earthly life. Huge numbers of these people report that as they clinically died, they felt themselves leaving their bodies. They looked down, perhaps they observed how the surgeons were desperately trying to do something. There was a tunnel, and they were drawn through it. And at the end of the tunnel, they met their deceased friends and relatives who were overjoyed to see them and full of love. And then they were interviewed by a being of light, a being of enormous power and knowledge, which loved them passionately, but also showed them their entire life, everything they had done, and how their good deeds had contributed greatly to the well-being of others, and how their bad deeds had done serious harm. And the person who is seeing his life, her life, is so proud of her good deeds and so ashamed of her bad deeds. At that point, the person has to return. If they don't return, they can't come back at all. Okay? Now, people who want to hang on to naturalistic explanations of everything, then say, well, these are merely hallucinations produced by a dying brain. But we would normally assume that a dying brain would produce no experience at all. Someone hits us over the head with a crowbar, we normally black out. But if it did produce experiences, they would be incoherent, as our dreams tend to be. But those are not the experiences which people report. They report the experiences were coherent. Now we come to a major philosophic problem. For centuries, philosophers have asked us, how do we know that what we're experiencing when we're awake is not a dream? How do we distinguish dreams from reality? The answer seems to be, if there's any answer at all, dreams are not as coherent as ordinary reality. And on a gut level, we just somehow know, or at least deeply feel, that ordinary reality is true and dreams aren't true in the same sense. But these near-death, out-of-body experiences pass the tests of coherence and of a sense of this being real, even more real, perhaps, than everyday experience. A final illustration of the present situation where we are struggling with the question of what are the limits of natural explanation is the usefulness of beauty as a criterion for formulating scientific hypotheses. In some fields, like cosmology, our data is often quite limited, and scientists have learned from experience that often a hypothesis which is mathematically beautiful, which in terms of pure logic and ideas seems to be just splendid, turns out to be correct when more empirical evidence becomes available. If the universe is simply the product of accident, why should beauty be useful in discovering scientific truth? Some scientists have continued to insist that there must be naturalistic explanations for everything, for how our minds work, how the universe works, for religious experience, for everything. But the naturalistic explanations suggested seem often to be mere speculation with no empirical basis and wildly improbable. For example, a naturalist explanation for the Big Bang. The most popular reductionist explanation of why the laws of physics and the Big Bang itself seem fine-tuned for life is to claim that the universe in which we live is only one of a huge number of other universes, which are popularly dubbed multiverses. Each of these universes, we are told, has a different set of physical laws, and that we just happen to be in the one where the physical laws are exactly right for the formation of life. But there's no empirical evidence to support this, and the number of multiverses required is huge. The estimate I read was for the fine-tuning to be accidental, in our universe, there would have to be 10 to the 160th other multiverses. That's one followed by 160 zeros. And maybe by definition, we could never have any empirical evidence that such universes exist because they are so far away that even light would never reach us. Other scientists have concluded that we just can't continue pretending that there's a naturalist explanation for everything, that we have to begin considering whether there might be a religious explanation required. Robert Jastrow claims to be an agnostic, someone who does not know whether he believes in the spiritual or at least the divine or not. He was very important in the American space program. He has a PhD in physics and teaches and so forth. He wrote a book, and in that book there is a paragraph which subsequently has become famous. I quote him. "For the scientist who has lived by his faith in the power of reason, the story ends like a bad dream. He has scaled the mountains of ignorance. He's about to conquer the highest peak. As he pulls himself over the final rock, he is greeted by a band of theologians who have been sitting there for centuries." And so the story ends, or rather, it becomes your story. Your generation now must take over the discussion of the evolution of love, religion, and science, and the future interactions of these things. So far in the lecture, I have given what I hope is at least a reasonably factual analysis of what has happened. I don't claim that it is fully objective. Many people, myself included, feel there is no such thing as total objectivity. I am a Christian, and my viewpoints, I trust, have been obvious. But nevertheless, I hope everything I've said is at least factually defensible. But here is my intuition of what needs to happen now, of the path that perhaps your generation might best explore. First, we need to continue to affirm all the discoveries of science. The days are long past when religion has the right to say that even though science has proven something empirically, it can't be true because it contradicts the Bible or something. No, we must affirm all the discoveries of science. But I would suggest we also need to affirm the basic religious discovery of a cosmic love, of a universal love, which has a kind of energy, an energy which certainly energizes humans, but I suspect also can affect non-human things. Then I would suggest we might work on the hypothesis that this cosmic love is one, but only one, factor in cosmic and natural evolution, that this love also played a role, and so not everything which otherwise would be considered an accident really was an accident. And I would conclude by saying perhaps we can begin an era in which science and religion are partners in explaining reality, and that as we come to know science and religion individually better, we see them as complementary ways of enlarging our knowledge. Thank you very much.
Well, you heard it here on Penguin Radio, radio.dominican.edu. Dr. Scott Sinclair speaking about the evolution of love, religion, and science, a brief history of a big topic. Big history here at Dominican University of California. Thank you and good night.